expression from his face. "All right," he said into the telephone. He listened to the stream of vituperation from the other end, then replaced the receiver gently in its cradle. "What was that one?" McIntyre asked. He was unshaven, tie loose, shirt unbuttoned. "Another fisherman," Gelson said. "Seems the watchbirds won't let him fish, even though his family is starving." "What are we going to do about it? He wants to know." "How many hundred is that?" "I don't know. I haven't opened the mail." "Well, I figured out where the trouble is," McIntyre said gloomily, with the air of a man who knows just how he blew up the Earth, after it was too late. "Let's hear it. Everybody took it for granted that we wanted all murder stopped. We figured the watchbirds would think as we do. We ought to have qualified the conditions." "I've got an idea," Kelson said, "that we'd have to know just why and what murder is before we could qualify the conditions properly. And if we knew that, we wouldn't need the watchbirds." "Oh, I don't know about that. They just have to be told that some things which look like murder are not murder." "But why should they stop fishermen?" Kelson asked. "Why shouldn't they? Fish and animals are living organisms. You just don't think that killing them is murder." The telephone rang. Kelson glared at it and punched the intercom. "I told you, no more calls, no matter what." "This is from Washington," his secretary said. "I thought you'd..." "Sorry." Kelson picked up the telephone. "Yes, certainly is a mess." "Have they?" All right, I certainly will." He put down the telephone. "Short and sweet," he told McIntyre. "We're to shut down temporarily." "That won't be so easy," McIntyre said. "The watchbirds operate independent of any central control, you know. They come back once a week for a repair checkup. We'll have to turn them off then, one by one." "Well, let's get to it. Monroe over on the coast has shut down about a quarter of his birds." "I think I can dope out a restricting circuit," McIntyre said. "Fine," Gelson replied bitterly. "You make me very happy." The watchbirds were learning rapidly, expanding and adding to their knowledge. Loosely defined abstractions were extended, acted upon, and re-extended to stop murder. Metal and electrons reason well, but not in a human fashion. A living organism? Any living organism. The watchbirds set themselves the task of protecting all living things. The fly buzzed around the room, lighting on a tabletop, pausing a moment, then darting to a windowsill. The old man stalked it, a rolled newspaper in his hand. Murderer. The watchbird swept down and saved the fly in the nick of time. The old man writhed on the floor a minute, and then was silent. He had been given only a mild shock, but it had been enough for his fluttery, cranky heart. His victim had been saved, though, and this was the important thing. Save the victim, give the aggressor his just deserts. Gelson demanded angrily, "Why aren't they being turned off?" The assistant control engineer gestured. In a corner of the repair room lay the senior control engineer. He was just regaining consciousness. "He tried to turn one of them off," the assistant engineer said. Both his hands were knotted together. He was making a visible effort not to shake. "That's ridiculous. They haven't got any sense of self-preservation." "Then turn them off yourself. Besides, I don't think any more are going to come." What could have happened? Gelson began to piece it together. The watchbirds still hadn't decided on the limits of a living organism. When some of them were turned off in the Monroe plant, the rest must have correlated the data. So they had been forced to assume that they were living organisms as well. No one had ever told them otherwise. Certainly they carried on most of the functions of living organisms. Then the old fears hit him. Gelson trembled and hurried out of the repair room. He wanted to find McIntyre in a hurry. The nurse handed the surgeon the sponge. "Scalpel." She placed it in his hand. He started to make the first incision. and then he was aware of a disturbance. "Who let that thing in?" "I don't know," the nurse said, her voice muffled by the mask. "Get it out of here." The nurse waved her arms at the bright-winged thing, but it fluttered over her head. The surgeon proceeded with the incision, as long as he was able. Watchbird drove him away and stood guard. "Telephone the Watchbird Company," the surgeon ordered. "Get them to turn the thing off." The Watchbird was preventing violence to a living organism. The surgeon stood by, helplessly, while his patient died. Fluttering high above the network of highways, the Watchbird watched and waited. It had been constantly working for weeks now, without rest or repair. Rest and repair were impossible, because the Watchbird couldn't allow itself, a living organism, to be murdered. And that was what happened when Watchbirds returned to the factory. There was a built-in order to return, after the lapse of a certain time period, but the Watchbird had a stronger order to obey, preservation of life, including its own. The definitions of murder are almost infinitely extended now, impossible to cope with, but the Watchbird didn't consider that. Responded to its stimuli, whenever they came, and whatever their source. There is a new definition of living organism in its memory files. It had come as a result of the Watchbird discovery that Watchbirds were living organisms, and it had enormous ramifications. The stimuli came. For the 100th time that day, the bird wheeled and banked, dropping swiftly down to stop murder. Jackson yawned and pulled his car to a shoulder of the road. He didn't notice the glittering dot in the sky. There was no reason for him to. Jackson wasn't contemplating murder by any human definition. This was a good spot for a nap, he decided. He had been driving for 7 straight hours, and his eyes were starting to fog. He reached out to turn off the ignition key, and was knocked back against the side of the car. "What in the hell's wrong with you?" he asked indignantly. "All I want to do is..." He reached for the key again, and again, he was smacked back. Jackson knew better than to try a third time. He'd been listening to the radio. He knew what the Watchbirds did to stubborn violators. "You mechanical jerk," he said to the waiting metal bird. "The car is not alive. I'm not trying to kill it." But the Watchbird only knew that a certain operation resulted in stopping an organism. The car was certainly a functioning organism. Wasn't it of metal, as were the Watchbirds? Didn't it run? You were listening to WRCT Pittsburgh. This is Sleepy Time Tea. I'll be continuing past the hour. McIntyre said, "Without repairs, they'll run down." He shoved a pile of specification sheets out of his way. "How soon?" Gelson asked. 6 months to a year. Say, a year, barring accidents." "A year," Gelson said. "In the meantime, everything's stopping dead. Do you know the latest?" "What?" "The Watchbirds have decided that the Earth is a living organism. They won't allow farmers to break ground for plowing. And of course, everything else is a living organism. Rabbits, beetles, flies, wolves, mosquitoes, lions, crocodiles, crows, and smaller forms of life, such as bacteria." "I know," McIntyre said. "And you tell me they'll wear out in 6 months? Or a year? What happens now? What are we going to eat in 6 months? The engineer rubbed his chin. "We'll have to do something quick and fast. Ecological balance has gone to hell. Fast isn't the word. Instantaneously would be better." Gelson lighted his 35th cigarette for the day. "At least I have the bitter satisfaction of saying, I told you so. Although I'm just as responsible as the rest of the machine-worshipping fools." McIntyre wasn't listening. He was thinking about Watchbirds. "Like the rabbit plague in Australia. The death rate is mounting," Gelson said. "Famine. Floods. Can't cut down trees. Doctors can't..." "What was that you said about Australia?" "The rabbits," McIntyre repeated. "Hardly any left in Australia now." "Why? How was it done?" "Oh, found some kind of germ that only attacked rabbits. Think it was propagated by mosquitoes?" "Work on that," Gelson said. "You might have something. I want you to get on the telephone. Ask for an emergency hookup with the engineers of the other companies. Hurry it up. Together, you may be able to dope out something. Right, McIntyre said. He grabbed a handful of blank paper and hurried to the telephone. What did I tell you? Officer Keltrick said. He grinned at the captain. Didn't I tell you scientists were nuts? I didn't say you were wrong, did I? The captain asked. No, but you weren't sure. Well, I'm sure now. You better get going. There's plenty of work for you. I know. Keltrick slew his revolver from its holster, checked it, and put it back. Are all the boys back, Captain? All? The captain laughed humorlessly. Homicide has increased by 50%. There's more murder now than there's ever been. Sure, Keltrick said. The watchbirds are too busy guarding cars and slugging spiders. He started toward the door, then turned for a parting shot. Take my word, Captain. Machines are stupid. The captain nodded. Thousands of watchbirds trying to stop countless millions of murders, a hopeless task. But the watchbirds didn't hope. Without consciousness, they experienced no sense of accomplishment, no fear of failure. Patiently, they went about their jobs, obeying each stimulus as it came. They couldn't be everywhere at the same time, but it wasn't necessary to be. People learned quickly what the watchbirds didn't like and refrained from doing it. It just wasn't safe. With their high speed and super fast senses, the watchbirds got around quickly. And now they meant business. In the original directives, there had been a provision made for killing a murderer if all other means failed. Why spare a murderer? It backfired. The watchbirds extracted the fact that murder and crimes of violence had increased geometrically since they had begun operation. This was true because their new definitions increased the possibilities of murder. But to the watchbirds, the rise showed that the first methods had failed. Simple logic. If A doesn't work, try B. The watchbirds shocked to kill. Slaughterhouses in Chicago stopped, and cattle starved to death in their pens because farmers in the Midwest couldn't cut hay or harvest grain. No one had told the watchbirds that all life depends on carefully balanced murders. Starvation didn't concern the watchbirds, since it was an act of omission. Their interest lay only in acts of commission. Hunters sat home, glaring at the silver dots in the sky, longing to shoot them down, but for the most part, they didn't try. The watchbirds were quick to sense the murder intent and to punish it. Fishing boats swung idle at their moorings in San Pedro and Gloucester. Fish were living organisms. Farmers cursed and spat and died trying to harvest the crop. Grain was alive and thus worthy of protection. Potatoes were as important to the watchbird as any other living organism. The death of a blade of grass was equal to the assassination of a president to the watchbirds. And of course, certain machines were living. This followed, since the watchbirds were machines and living. God help you if you maltreated your radio. Turning it off meant killing it. Obviously, its voice was silenced, the red glow of its tubes faded, it grew cold. The watchbirds tried to guard their other charges. Wolves were slaughtered, trying to kill rabbits. Rabbits were electrocuted, trying to eat vegetables. Creepers were burned out in the act of strangling trees. A butterfly was executed, caught in the act of outraging a rose. This control was spasmodic because of the fewness of the watchbirds. A billion watchbirds couldn't have carried out the ambitious project set by the thousands. The effect was of a murderous force, 10,000 bolts of irrational lightning raging around the country, striking 1,000 times a day. Lightning which anticipated your moves and punished your intentions. Gentlemen, please, the government representative begged. We must hurry. Seven manufacturers stopped talking. Before we begin this meeting formally, President Monroe said, I want to say something. We do not feel ourselves responsible for this unhappy state of affairs. It was a government project. The government must accept the responsibility, both moral and financial. Gelson shrugged his shoulders. It was hard to believe that these men, just a few weeks ago, had been willing to accept the glory of saving the world. Now, they wanted to shrug off the responsibility when the salvation went amiss. I'm positive that that need not concern us now, the representative assured him. We must hurry. You engineers have done an excellent job. I'm proud of the cooperation you have shown in this emergency. You are hereby empowered to put the outlined plan into action. Wait a minute, Gelson said. There's no time. The plan's no good. Don't you think it'll work? Of course it'll work, but I'm afraid the cure will be worse than the disease. The manufacturers looked as though they would have enjoyed throttling Gelson. He didn't hesitate. Haven't we learned yet? He asked. Don't you see that you can't cure human problems by mechanization? Mr. Gelson, President Monroe said, I would enjoy hearing you philosophize, but unfortunately, people are being killed. Crops are being ruined. There's famine in some sections of the country already. The watchbirds must be stopped at once. Murder must be stopped, too. I remember all of us agreeing upon that. But this is not the way. What would you suggest? The representative asked. Gelson took a deep breath. What he was about to say took all the courage he had. Let the watchbirds run down by themselves, Gelson suggested. There was a near riot. The government representative broke it up. Let's take our lesson, Gelson urged. Admit that we were wrong trying to cure human problems by mechanical means. Start again. Use machines, yes, but not as judges and teachers and fathers. Ridiculous, the representative said coldly. Mr. Gelson, you are overwrought. I suggest you control yourself. He cleared his throat. All of you are ordered by the president to carry out the plan you've submitted. He looked sharply at Gelson. Not to do so will be treason. I'll cooperate to the best of my ability, Gelson said. Good. Those assembly lines must be rolling within the week. Gelson walked out of the room, alone. Now he was confused again. Had he been right, or was he just another visionary? Certainly, he hadn't explained himself with much clarity. Did he know what he meant? Gelson cursed under his breath. He wondered why he couldn't ever be sure of anything. Weren't there any values he could hold on to? He hurried to the airport and to his plant. The watchbird was operating erratically now. Many of its delicate parts were out of line, worn by almost continuous operation, but gallantly responded when the stimuli came. A spider was attacking a fly. The watchbird swooped down to the rescue. Simultaneously, it became aware of something overhead. The watchbird wheeled to meet it. There was a sharp crackle, and a power bolt whizzed by the watchbird's wing. Angrily, it spat a shockwave. The attacker was heavily insulated. Again, it spat at the watchbird. This time, a bolt smashed through a wing. The watchbird darted away, but the attacker went after it in a burst of speed, throwing out more crackling power. The watchbird fell, but managed to send out its message. Urgent, a new message. Urgent, a new menace to living organisms, and this was the deadliest yet. Other watchbirds around the country integrated the message. Their thinking centers searched for an answer. Well, Chief, they bagged 50 today, McIntyre said, coming into Gelson's office. Fine, Gelson said, not looking at the engineer. Not so fine. McIntyre sat down. Lord, I'm tired. It was 72 yesterday. I know. On Gelson's desk were several dozen lawsuits, which he was sending to the government with a prayer. They'll pick up again, though, McIntyre said confidently. The hawks are especially built to hunt down watchbirds. They're stronger, faster, and they've got better armor. We really rolled them out in a hurry, huh? We sure did. The watchbirds are pretty good too, McIntyre had to admit. They're learning to take cover. They're trying a lot of stunts, you know? Each one that goes down tells the others something. Gelson didn't answer. But anything the watchbirds can do, the hawks can do better, McIntyre said cheerfully. The hawks have special learning circuits for hunting. They're more flexible than the watchbirds. They learn faster. Gelson gloomily stood up, stretched, and walked to the window. The sky was blank. Looking out, he realized that his uncertainties were over. Right or wrong, he had made up his mind. Tell me, he said, still watching the sky, what will the hawks hunt after they get all the watchbirds? Huh? McIntyre said. Why? Just to be on the safe side, you'd better design something to hunt down the hawks. Just in case, I mean. You think? All I know is that the hawks are self-controlled. So were the watchbirds. Remote control would have been too slow, the argument went on. The idea was to get the watchbirds and get them fast. That meant no restricting circuits. You can dope something out, McIntyre said uncertainly. You've got an aggressive machine up in the air now. A murder machine. Before that, it was an anti-murder machine. Your next gadget will have to be even more self-sufficient, won't it? McIntyre didn't answer. I don't hold you responsible, Gelson said. It's me. It's everyone. In the air outside was a swift-moving dot. That's what comes, said Gelson, of giving a machine the job that was our own responsibility. Overhead, a hawk was zeroing in on a watchbird. The armored murder machine had learned a lot in a few days. Its sole function was to kill. At present, it was impelled toward a certain type of living organism, metallic like itself. But the hawk had just discovered that there were other types of living organisms too, which had to be murdered. That was Watchbird by Robert Sheckley. Before that, we read The Eyes Have It by Philip K. Dick, and we started off the hour with To Be Or Not to Be by Kurt Vonnegut. This has been another edition of Sleepy Time Tea with Chamomile. As always, listener-suggested stories can be sent to sideways.radio@gmail.com. Tune in next week for another bedtime story. It'll probably be less unsettling than these ones, but, you know, want to add some flavor sometimes. You've been listening to WRCT Pittsburgh.
WRCT Pittsburgh. It's more fun when it doesn't make any sense.
Thank you. RCT Pittsburgh, the last bastion of pulchritude.
Your it will creep. It starts when you're always afraid. Step out of line, the man come and take you away. We better stop. Hey, what's that sound? Everybody look what's going down. We better stop. Hey, what's that sound? Everybody look what's going down. We better stop now. What's that sound? Everybody look what's going down.
WRCT Pittsburgh. It's Sean Watson. You're listening to A Minute Pause. It is my show. Happens every Tuesday, 10 a.m. until 2 p.m. Just three songs into the show. You just heard 10 Years After, I'd Love to Change the World from the album A Space in Time. Before that, the Buffalo Springfield with For What It's Worth, and started everything off with the Rolling Stones' Sad Day from a London 45. Got a lot more coming for you in the rock vein with a bunch of 45s. Gonna do or just rattle them off. The Human Beings, Shadows of Night, Maurice Williams, and the Zodiacs, the Standells, the Jaggers, the Chains, Nobody's Children, Riders of the Mark, the Sonics, them, and then Nazareth, Pat Benatar, George Harrison, Kenny Loggins. A couple classic punk songs at the end of this hour, which would be The Undertones, You've Got My Number, Why Don't You Use It, and Husker Du, 8 Miles High. I'm sure I pronounced everything completely great. All right, got to tell you some stuff here for this hour. Do you ride a bicycle or walk in Pittsburgh? Do you want safer streets and respect for motorists? Bike Pittsburgh is a nonprofit organization that works to improve biking and walking in order to reduce the harmful effects of car dependence in our communities. For free resources and programs, connect with Bike Pittsburgh on social media at BikePGH and at BikePGH.org. WRCT is supported by Attic Records. Attic Records is an independently owned and operated shop that buys and sells new and used records and CDs. Attic Records is located at 513 Grant Avenue in Millville. More information is available at 412-821-8484 or at atticrecordstoreinc.com. Listen to better music. Consolidation is on Wednesday evenings from 7 to 10 p.m. All right, back into the music. Like I said, The Human Beings is up next. A bunch of 45s for a set on my show. 1 o'clock is the radio music calendar. The playlist is at wrct.org. This is The Human Beings, Nobody But Me, from a Capital 45.
Do the shit like I do. you a story. I'm gonna tell you about my town. I'm gonna tell you a big fat story, baby. It's all about my town. Yeah, down by the river, down by the banks of the River Charles. That's what's happening, baby. That's where you'll find me.
left me alone. She hurt me, can't you see? So I got to run,
run and hide.
Gonna get away from you, child.
Run and hide.
All alone to stay.
Run and hide.
Girl, I gotta get away.
Run and hide.
Girl, I'm gonna get away.
Run and hide.
Girl, you said that you love me. Girl, said that you'd be true. Said I was your one and only. But now, child, you're leaving me blue. Girl, what can I do? So I got to run,
run and hide.
Gonna get away from you.
Run and hide.
Gonna run away, child.
Run and hide.
Girl, I gotta get away. She left me alone. She hurt me, can't you see? And so I got to run,
run and hide.
I'm gonna get away from you.
Run and hide.
Girl, I gotta get away.
Run and hide.
Gotta get away.
Run and hide.
Girl, I gotta get away.
Run and hide.
All alone to stay. Girl, what can I do? Nothing to say.
Nothing seen. Now here. Lost the ride.